the chairman of the Senate committee, military committee, was a warm friend of mine, but he was an ardent supporter of the Marine development, and finally forced a test for the benefit of the Senate committee. We'd had all our military tests and everything, and they're all in favor of the Grand Rival, but under this pressure, a very difficult situation was created, and it wasn't improved by the head of the Marine Corps, long since retired, when he came out, naturally in favor of the Marine Rival. I say Marine, but I mean by this ex-officer of the Marine Corps who developed the gun. Those are the things that are always very difficult to handle and take an immense amount of time when there's so many compelling things.
Well, I thought you were going to turn your page.
When there are so many compelling things that you have to do. 103. That is a very difficult question to answer, and I don't think you can answer it, other than to say that each one is of vital importance in its particular field. An army without tanks over in Europe at that time would have been in a very fatal position. An army without ground would have been lost. An army without artillery, I think, would have been very sorely afflicted. But if you had them all and they're efficient, they each have their place, and you go from there. I can't answer that because I'm not sufficiently familiar with the new developments and the new equipment that is available and its performance. Questions of this sort, criticisms of tanks, planes, other equipment, are very common, certainly to an army of democracy. And a particular type of newsman will get on one subject and make that his play. And of course, every military sympathizer who's an officer in the field, we will say, feeds him the ammunition for his newspaper gun, and members of Congress will take that up. If they're hostile to you, then they can make it very difficult for you. I was very fortunate in having quite a friendly Congress. I had to labor with them. I had to make plain to them these various things, but they were not set out to destroy me. They were set out to help me, and these issues would come up, which they'd be very much impressed by wherever they got it, from a newspaper man who'd been on the front or from matters of that sort. But it was done without the prejudice that often accompanies such pressures, where they have antagonism to the principal officer concerned. My main trouble was in getting the thing on an impartial basis. For instance, tanks. We had a very difficult time settling on the pattern for the tanks. And naturally I had all the American side. Chaffee was the head of the tank corps at that time. And I got the principal Britisher, confidentially, and told him to tell me, I wouldn't repeat what he said, but just tell me exactly in the frankest possible way what he wanted to say about this tank question as to the importance of the American side and the British side. Well, I very readily came to the feeling that the trouble was this. The American tank was far more mobile. We had had a great deal of mobility involved in the tractors and things of that sort, so that we understood that. And I thought our tank was far and away beyond the British tank in mobility and being able to handle it. On the other hand, I thought the British tank had its fighting characteristics for the crew and matters of that sort far ahead of ours, because they'd had experience in that and they knew what it was. So my effort was to bring about the settlement of the thing on the basis of what the Americans did best and what the British did best, without any prejudice in connection with either one. And I literally settled the tank dispute on that basis with the civilian who was largely responsible for the adjustment and who is now one of the heads of industry. I'll not go into the question of his name. With the planes, it grew less difficult as time went on. At first, there was a regular war between those who were opposed to large planes and those who were in favor of large planes. Those in favor of large planes were almost to the point of ignoring any plane that could help the troops, which was a fatal mistake. And those opposed to the large bomber planes were again, as we can all see today, making a fatal mistake. Well, it was necessary to compromise these judgments and get the thing underway without prejudice, if it was possible to do so. I'd always find certain officers that would approach the thing purely objectively, and I would depend on them to a very large degree, but I'd do it quietly, and I'd get myself armed for whatever discussions I had to go through and whatever decisions I had to make. But that is inherent in practically all these questions. The only thing they didn't oppose much was the Jeep. They all opposed its development, and then were all strong for it, if they could get enough. I don't know but what the battle over the tanks was probably the most difficult to handle. There were great difficulties about the planes, but they were of a nature that were largely, or more you might say, industrial. But in all these things, the difficulties in a democracy are that everybody can find the back door to the White House. And until you've proven yourself and are, you might say, in command of the situation, at least you have the respect to Congress, you have the respect to the Commander-in-Chief and all, it is very difficult, because this person, a classmate, will say, the President or somebody else gets to him and just proves that we don't know what we're doing at all. And he gets it from him, and this man probably talks well. I remember taking issue with... Turn it on. Early in the period between 39 and 40, I had great difficulty in meeting what I would call the backdoor influences. It would manifest itself in a variety of ways. I did a number of things to meet this. First place, I was very careful not to get mad. And then I got a collection of rather leading fellows on the Hill, and I would have them come down and give them very intimate talks on what the situation was and what our position was. That helped a great deal. And I was able to meet these difficulties somewhat in that manner. But I repeat again, I had to keep my temper very carefully, and that to be long-suffering, and had to have a tremendous amount of my time consumed in meeting this sort of influence. You couldn't ignore it, and to get mad didn't do any good at all. I had officers who had specific individuals that they must go around with and keep straight. I know General Collins, who afterwards became Chief of Staff of the Army and was a very celebrated corps commander in Europe, and who captured Cherbourg. He had a single individual, civilian, who was very intimate of the President, and Collins had to stay with him all the time, and if he traveled, take him around and stay right with him all the time. Otherwise, he'd get loose and no telling what would happen next. I had quite a number of these, and each one of my people had a thing like, I remember Smith, a very conspicuous reputation, Bedell Smith. He had a particular man he had to look after. any number of them had these assignments. And their job was to keep right on the in touch with these officers. And if the fellow wanted to travel, take him. But stay with him and try to keep the thing straight. There'd be some man that was a classmate of the president. We had to have an officer stay with him all the time, practically. The officer couldn't trail him or anything like that. But he was always available, and he was always in touch with what was going on. And in that way, we could finally get things over the bar in some degree of safety. But you couldn't ignore these things. And I had to do it in some such way as that, or I never would have had time to do my own work. But the first rule of all was I had to keep my temper. Because in a sense, you had every right to get furious, considering how grave the hazards were. That didn't develop later on in the war much, because they conceded that you knew and that you were being successful. But before that, they all knew far better than I knew. Anyone could tell me just exactly. You could learn more on Wall Street or up in New York by far than you could in the War Department. ...106. Foch said that the plan was 10% and the execution was 90%. Well, that is correct today, just as it was when Foch said it. It's always been correct. It's not very difficult to get at the plan of these things. The great difficulty is observing the execution and pushing it at the weak point and getting it ahead. And those things require not only great ability as a leader, great ability as a to demand the respect of all the people, and great ability as a staff officer. But you've got to go. I sometimes have wondered how I could have gotten along with 9 different theaters of operations and over 8.5 million men in the service. Of course, many more than that, counting those that came in and went out again, one way or another. If I hadn't been able to fly, during the early formations of the Army, I used to fly every other week, almost all week. Well, of course, I could go great distances in a very short time and deal with things there. I never got caught in a review but once. And I would go right to where they were working when I got to the place. And as a rule, I wouldn't tell them when I was coming because I just wanted to see exactly what they were doing at that particular time. And then I left. I tried as far as I could to avoid meals and take them entirely on the plane. And the planes were not as well served in those days as they are today. But I got a very good Filipino. They procured him for me so that he could give me very decent meals and relaxation. I never liked to take anybody with me on the plane. I tried that at first, and I found the talk all the time and kept me from relaxing. What I wanted to do is to sit down, take off put on a flying coat, and put on sneakers or put on, moccasins, loafers, and sit down in one chair with my feet on the other and probably read the Saturday Evening Post or some such book as that. I always had a collection of these Army books that we had printed, so that the big problem of me is to get around and see these things, find out how they were going on at the time, and I had to carry that all over the world. And I think my mileage towards the end, I don't remember whether it was while I was Secretary of State or when I ended as Chief of Staff, but it was 1,400,000 miles. And so I was involved in a tremendous amount of travel. I got caught up with things right then, saw the situation, and could take action in many cases within the hour by communicating back to Washington in regard to these matters, which we had not understood or which required something more of correction that had to start from headquarters. But the traveling was very important. I was quite surprised when I got out to Fort Sill. I was there a number of times. I found this was the first time the Chief of Staff had ever been to Fort Sill. But of course, they didn't have planes in those days. But on this occasion, I could go great distances in a very short time. And I was, about every other week, I was on the go entirely. And sometimes I went all night and got my sleep on the plane. and that saved a day in there. You can't take for granted how things are going to work out. You've got to see. You've got to follow up. Not interfere, not irritate people, but you get there. I think the best lesson of that sort that you can get is Wellington's campaign in Portugal and Spain. His campaigns, I should say. Johnny, you're going to get shot if you grab that instrument. I can't emphasize this too much, that if you just get out a plan and sit back, well, you're lost. And on the other hand, if you get out a plan and then irritate the other fellow, you're lost again. And that, the method you do that has to be very largely influenced by the character of the army that you're dealing with, or the troops you're dealing with at the time. I think the German command relationship, until Hitler began to take it all apart, was, so far as military affairs are concerned, was the best. Because, of course, they had a very highly disciplined army and a higher disciplined officer force. The Russians, I don't know enough about it. It seemed to be a very arbitrary manner. If they didn't like it, they shot you, which is one way of getting things done. The British, they got people like Montgomery eventually and all, but they had a pretty slow time doing it and great difficulties doing it. They had the same problem as we have on the political situation. I might say that I was very fortunate in regard to that. I was very fortunate that the president didn't interfere with me on command and allowed me more or less complete freedom of action. And it was only when I got into the business of reducing these fellows that I got into difficulties with the president, because that instantly produced great political pressures that we were doing all wrong. We were victimizing an individual, and he shouldn't be reduced. And when that became particularly evident when we started to demobilize, and you naturally had to cut down command, and that was a very tragic thing to have to do. But when it got into a political swarm, then it was all the worse. I recall one situation that took a very curious trail. In the first place, there was a man who had been, that I knew very intimately, out in the West, who had gotten into the school that I started myself at Charlottesville for the training of officers to be put into villages and cities and towns to conduct that part of the administration of captured territory, or freed territory for that matter. I had gone in myself as a second lieutenant with no instructions of any kind whatsoever, no school of any kind whatsoever, and not even an army regulation. A storm had destroyed practically all the papers, and what I could find was in a barrel, rain-soaked, and I had to make up all my returns. I was the only officer there, and I had some of my early returns for property I had to deal with and supplies I had to issue were made up almost out of my imagination. But I was given no instructions at all, and I was practically governor, in effect, of quite a large territory, about half an island. And I made certain. And then I remember in the First World War, it wasn't until after the war, actual fighting, that they started in to try to get a hold of officers that had been trained, some by Funston in Mexico, and began circulating to get any copies of the information and regulations that had been gotten out at that time. So I started this school at Charlottesville, and the head of the school was confirmed by the Secretary of War. It was a very fine lawyer from New York whose father had been, I think, Attorney General before him. Now, of course, I've forgotten his name at the moment. And he was put in charge of this school down there, and a very capable colonel of the regular army was put in charge of the real management of the school. And we got this started. Well, the first thing I had to do was stop divisions commanders from sending officers there they wanted to get rid of. They didn't want their chief of staff, but they didn't quite have the nerve to reduce him or get him transferred. And so they would want to send him to the school like that. That'd be kick him upstairs, as it were. And I had to act very drastically with several of them for using this as a convenience to get rid of people that they didn't have the nerve to do themselves. And one of these was a fellow from out the Midwest, and he was well known for his characteristics, which we weren't very excited about. And by his same name was another officer who was another individual who was the intimate of one of the distinguished Republicans, and was anathema to Mr. Roosevelt. There were some accusations that this school down there was teaching a kind of government that is not compatible with our American type of government, that we were trying to organize a new government. They said everything that I think everything that we were. They didn't claim that we were making glass, but I never heard of so many fool cracks about it. Mr. Simpson came back from a cabinet meeting that lasted almost all afternoon, and I discovered that they'd been discussing entirely this particular officer, whose name was that of that same as that of a intimate of one-time Republican leaders. And Mr. Roosevelt was very bitter about this matter, and Mr. Simpson was very much stirred up over it. And I listened to this thing, and I finally found out that they were talking about somebody that didn't even know wasn't the officer at all. And I was already investigating because I thought they'd kicked him upstairs and loaded this school up with a man that had no business there. And I was shocked when I found how long Cabinet spent a whole afternoon warring over this thing. And I expressed my surprise and incredulity that such a thing would happen. Mr. Truman called up the president then, Mr. Simpson called up the president then, and explained that they were talking about the wrong man all the time, that they're so excited. But that got the school on the carpet, as it were. And they claimed all sorts of things about the school. I called attention to Mr. Simpson to the fact that he had confirmed the head of the institution, who was a very fine officer. He was a reserve officer. And he was a general, and his father had been in high cabinet position, and he was an altogether fine man. But the thing got so bad that I had to have an investigation of a certain individual who was on the Army staff. And Mr. Roosevelt got after me once or twice, and finally I called this man in, and I said, why haven't you reported back the result of your investigation about this? Well, he said, I was ashamed to. Well, I said, what are you ashamed about? Well, he said, I didn't want to tell you. Well, I said, my gosh, I said, you were to investigate. Now, what was it? Well, he said, I found out that there was supposed to be, just supposed to be, a plot of which this particular individual, who they're all talking about, was to be the president of this new republic, and you were to be the vice president. Well, I said, I can tell you right now the first part of it. If there's anything to it, I was going to be the president. I was not going to be the vice president. But I said the thing was utterly ridiculous. And yet that had gotten to the point of among people of some sanity and some reserve. That had gotten up and twisted clear around to the cabinet. So I took it to Mr. Simpson, and he was very much embarrassed at talking to the president about it. And then the president showed me a list of a couple of fellows that were reserve officers who were generals and who were going to be relieved. We were reducing in every way we could because the discharges were going on very, very fast, and demobilization. And they thought this was showed a determination to expel all these people out of the army and build up a new republic or something of that sort. Nothing was too wild not to mention. And I was having the two officers relieved because there was no job for them. So they came to me to consult me about did they dare relieve these two political National Guardsmen, that's what it was, And that is, they were marshaling political power. And I said, go ahead and do it. And I told Mr. Roosevelt about this. He was very much taken back. But he was very much embarrassed because there was heavy pressure to retain them. Well, I said, Mr. Roosevelt, you just have to make a decision. You're going to have a nice a reserve army and no regular army. We'll demote all the regular officers and keep all the other officers. And of course, I exaggerated. Well, he said, not that exactly. But I said, will you let me handle it? And he said, all right. And he never spoke to me again about it. And we went ahead and reduced these people. But it was we had to get them out. We had to reduce our own regular generals. And I objected very much to be held as chief of staff because I'd made all these people. I'd relieved all the ones that I thought were not efficient enough to be retained. I'd made enemies of them and their families. Now I was being called on to reduce about 600 generals and make enemies of them too, and I wouldn't have anybody left but my wife by the time I got through with this thing, and I wanted to be relieved as chief of staff. And he made me hold on, Mr. Truman did that, until he brought Eisenhower back, and he was very slow about bringing Eisenhower back. And Eisenhower, he didn't want to come back either. Nobody wanted that job. So it was a very difficult period, and there were these wild ideas that people were plotting this and plotting that. Now, I might go on further about that school. In the first place, we got in trouble with it because Mr. Roosevelt forbade us to put these people into Sicily. We had sent them over and established a pool there in Africa, and we wanted them to go into Sicily and be the men trained to take charge of these villages. So right away, we would have somebody regulating those matters. And the village was picked out that each man was to take, and he was educated in connection to that village and everybody in it who might have influence in the matter. And Mr. Roosevelt at first forbade us to put them in there. We had them in a camp in Africa, and we couldn't do anything with them. Finally, we got so we moved them in. And this book that was a great bestseller, I forgot the name of that, that gave Patton the devil for shooting a hole in a tank or something, some of that sort. It was made into a play. It was the bestseller as a book and very popular as a play. But that was the officer that we had educated that was conducting this thing and had the part of the, was on the side of the villagers and in a sense against what the military were doing at that place. All of those things were very difficult to handle and so extraordinary you'll hardly believe them today. The feeling of uncertainty about such things as that. And all these plots that were taken to the president. And he had to pick out what was the important one and what was not. And it was no easy thing because the people that went to him were deeply prejudiced and very active. And I seldom went because if I got into all those discussions, I would soon exhaust my power entirely. As to that further answer to 107, I don't know what weaknesses I would say in command we had. I think our command question worked out very, very well. We had, comparatively speaking, few reliefs. We relieved men. General Eisenhower was very firm about that, and very courageous about that. And we relieved men on a number of occasions. But we did all our weeding out in this country. Whereas in the First World War, they left the weeding out to General Pershing in France, and he had a terrible time. I remember at one period, as I recall, there were 32 regular brigadier generals on the road at the same time going to the rear. And I may be off on that number because it's years back. But they'd given them all physical examinations and things of that sort. But I would say it didn't matter about the physical examination. He was going to get shot. He could function until he got shot. If he's going to get sick, he could function until he got sick. But what you want was a vigorous man who could command the respect of the troops, who could go at it aggressively in his leadership, who was not fatigued and therefore lowered in morale by reason of that fatigue. Uh, 109, the question of my being made a field marshal. I didn't want any promotion at all. I didn't need it. Chiefs of staff on the British side were already field marshals, so they'd be senior to me, whatever I was made. And I didn't think I needed that rank. And I didn't want to be beholden to Congress for any rank or anything of that kind. I wanted to be able to go in there with my skirts clean and with no personal ambitions concerned in any way, and I could get all I wanted with the rank I had. But that was twisted around, and somebody said that I didn't like the term Marshal because it's the same as my name. I know Mr. Churchill twitted me about this in a rather scathing tone. I don't recall that I ever made the expression. But my reason for not wanting it was, I thought it was much better that I personally shouldn't be beholden to anything for Congress except for fair treatment, which they gave me. Of course, I was under some pressure, but not as much as you might think. The pressure there came when I was relieving the man. I remember one occasion I had 13 senators come into my office at the same time to defend this man. And I finally said, well, I'll put it this way, gentlemen. I don't understand your position because I should think your constituents should be your principal interest. And here it seems to me you're only considering one constituent and ignoring all the other constituents who are members of the division. I'm concerned with them, and I'm determined to see if they get the best leadership that there is available. And I said, in this particular case, it's been given, we were very generous with this individual. We gave him a long time to ease himself out of this thing, and I don't think we could have done any better. I'm not going to leave him in command of that division. So I'll put it to you this way. If he stays, I go. And if I stay, he goes. And that broke up the meeting. And one senator came back the next day and said, you know, I told my wife about the meeting yesterday. And incidentally, he was the only one that spoke to me about it. And she said she was very happy her son was in the Army and that you were the head of the Army. I don't care to list these division and corps commanders unless I had some special reason for it at the time. Because when comparisons are odious, and if this book is a lot of comparisons of respective efficiency of this, that, and the other person, nobody will read the story except just to get at acrimonious features such as that. What's he got? Johnny? You want an orange? You look so pathetic. I will comment to you on this personally. Wartime Medicine, 113. I won't comment on that. You have better sources of information. What I wanted particularly from the doctors, there was one group of vast importance to us to man the hospitals and everything of that sort, where their scientific information was invaluable to us. There was another group that had to be executives and handle things in the field, and that was quite apart from their specialized knowledge, for which they were famous, you might say, in medicine or medicinal practices. I had great difficulty with that. I wanted the head of the medical corps during the war to be a great executive who could develop the medical corps and could see in the field that it was properly handled. And the pressure all were directed towards getting the great surgeon or the great medical leader. What you needed in Europe with the armies was the great executive to get these things set up, to get the hospitals, temporary things, the evacuations, everything of that sort going, and to see that the attention at the front was absolutely up to the peak of perfection. So I had some difficulty about this. A man might be a wonder at running a hospital, and yet on the other hand be unfitted for a field executive, which was the essential thing in the European theater. It's the medical problem. I think that that's 114. The principal medical problem was malaria, and I explained to you about that, where we had to go at that in order to save ourselves in the Southwest Pacific. We'd have a single division be out of action for over a year, as was the case, I think, of the 1st Marine Division, which was sent down to New Zealand. My chief medical problem was getting the hospital started in time. The draft was going at a tremendous rate. I know at one time there we were taking in as many men in a month as there were in the entire Navy. And the hospitals weren't finished. And you might say the patient went in one side and the shavings came out the other. And I had to get them started. And one officer who played a great part in this is now the medical aide to the president, General Snyder. I picked him up and sent him all over the world, but particularly all over this country, when the hospitals were being established. And he saw that the thing ran, that these overwhelming numbers of recruits coming in were attended. There was a flu epidemic at the time, and he saw that the proper steps were taken in advance in connection with that, and he had a very hard time because he never had a good plane, and flying was a little bit primitive at that time in some respects, and he just had to fly all the time and had some dreadful flights and very dangerous flights. But he was perfectly splendid at what he did and should have received great rewards for it. However, his work now is very much appreciated, I believe, with the president. I made him, incidentally, assistant inspector general. I don't recall that I even spoke to the inspector general department. They were pretty much hide bound, those fellas. So the first he knew about, I think, was when Snyder was made a brigadier general. The medical department didn't know about it. I put his name on the list and appointed him the minute he was made as assistant inspector general. Then he was put in charge of all inspections and everything of that sort relating in any way to medicine or health in connection with the draft. And that's where he came in these new hospitals, the handling of all the recruits on the medical end. And that gave me something to lean on, which I felt up to that time I didn't have at all. I did virtually the same thing with production. I had one inspector general whose practically principal job was to be in touch with all the production plants and things of that sort and equipment, and traveled all over the country to keep me advised of what was needed, where we were limping, and what should be done. Therefore, the inspector general was generally kept busy trying to figure out some question of an officer's payments to his divorced wife and things of that sort. But I got them right down to production, to health, and to one or two other things, which I won't mention here. One of them, I will say, was the colored question. Now, I might say right here now that I figured one of the greatest mistakes I made during the war was accepting the pressure of the staff. I don't want to exactly pin it on them, but they exerted great pressure on me. And I failed to sense what was going to be the real vital quality involved, or denouement involved. I wanted the camps kept largely in the south because they didn't have to have such construction as they would in the northern climate. And in addition to that, the training would be much facilitated because they could train outdoors for more days in the year. So I wanted, incidentally, all the colored divisions trained in the south. And the staff was very much opposed to that. They thought that the division should be near its district it came from. And they insisted on, some of these colored divisions in the north. Well, of course, they practically couldn't train at all. It was so cold. But what was the real difficulty was that I overlooked entirely, and I say it frankly, I overlooked entirely the, that's my wife, Johnny. Will you give this cannibal something to eat out there? I completely overlooked the fact that the tragic part of it would have these northern Negroes in the southern community. We couldn't change the bus arrangements. We couldn't change any of the things of that nature. And they found themselves very much circumscribed to them, outrageously so, because they were in there to train to fight for their country and put their lives ostensibly on the line, and they were being denied this and denied that and denied the other things that the white troops accepted as a matter of course. And it made it exceedingly difficult. And I know Jack McCloy, who was the Assistant Secretary of War, that was his particular one of his particular pigeons, and he would come down to see me with great frequency because he was always in trouble. And the matter of fact, at that time, under those conditions, there just wasn't any solution. We never should have coagulated the South with these Negro camps. We should have kept them in the North. But my refusal was not based on that understanding. I failed to visualize what was going to happen. And it caused us all sorts of difficulties, and I regard it as one of the most important mistakes I made in the mobilization of the Army. Because, as I say, there was no hope of settling that at that time. Anything of that kind would just lead to dissension, and we had enough on our hands to get a fighting army. I did not press 115. I did not press for the air evacuation in Europe. As a matter of fact, my pressure was the other way around. That was a very desirable thing, that air evacuation. But the trouble was we didn't have enough planes, and we wanted to use the planes for another military attack, but they were absorbed in air evacuation. Now the question was, did we evacuate more efficiently and progress with the war more slowly? And I felt that the saving in the end was in expediting the business of the war. And that, of course, led to taking these planes away from the evacuation of the wounded earlier than otherwise would have been the case. So I made it my business, particularly when they sent women to France, to explain this thing to them before they got there and heard the doctor's appeal for more planes. They had the planes until we had to have them for a further military operation. But that must not be delayed, because it is to our interest to end the war as quickly as possible. And while the evacuation of the wounded was better, well, they were actually, by doing so, would be losing the very battle they were wounded in trying to win for us. 116. I thought the medical corps as a whole was very efficient during the war. And I know the handling of the wounded on the battlefield always won great plaudits, great appreciation from all the men. And I think the medical corps acquitted itself very finely. The medical profession, I should say. Training. I do not think we had too much spit and polish. It has a certain disciplinary effect. It's very hard for the men to keep up anyway, and if you let that deteriorate, it was very, very bad, and the deeper the mud, the more important it was to spruce them up as quickly as you could thereafter. But if you let them rest in the mud, their morale went to pieces. So I would not say that spit and polish at all adversely affect the training. It had a very strong disciplinary effect. The training was realistic enough. In fact, we had the greatest maneuvers, I think, in peacetime of any military force has ever had. In fact, we took over West Texas and a part of almost all of Louisiana for a field of maneuver. We took a large part of Tennessee and, I believe, a little of Kentucky in the same way. And I know we took in the Carolinas, large acreage in order to have maneuvers, and we had as many as 500,000 men in a maneuver. I saw in the paper just yesterday some reference to the giant army maneuver they're going to have, and there are 20,000 troops involved. Don't do that, Johnny. And we'd had them up to 500,000. I remember one senator who's since retired coming to me and said, no, I went to him because he was he was on the committee up in Congress. I think he was the chairman of the committee. What does she want, Johnny? This senator objected to what I was doing, objected to the money I was expending on maneuvers. He said they had a critique and they exposed all these mistakes. Why do you do it with all those mistakes? Well, I said, my God, Senator, that's the reason I'm doing it. I want the mistake down in Louisiana, not over in Europe. And the only way to do this thing is try it out, and if it doesn't work, find out what we need to do to make it work. And here, for the first time, high command could be trained, because we could use these divisions. They weren't just called in the men for 2 weeks training, and we could march them long distances and do all the things you have to do in war, which is a very strenuous, terrible strain on the individual. And that gave the commanders an opportunity to exercise command and bear the result of their errors and profit by their successes. Eisenhower, for example, was chief of staff of General Kruger's command in the South. He came on from the Northwest for that purpose. All of them learned a great deal. I remember in the 500,000-man maneuvers down in Louisiana, I directed that they change their bases on each side, and they told me it would take a month or something like that and be very, very expensive. Well, I said they had to do it anyway because they'd have to do it in Europe, and I wanted to do it here. So they changed the bases. I know in one case, I remember exactly what the result was. It only took 10 days, and it only cost $40,000, I think. That seems a large sum for one maneuver like that. But it was a very economical sum when it came to the efficiency that it developed in the troops, and that's the reason Patton and Hodges and the others and Bradley were able to move so rapidly across the face of Europe. I think the officer school went along about along the lines prescribed. Of course, there was much less time in which to do it, and there was a much less qualified group to take the training. And but they did a very satisfactory job. I think the Marine argument about the training is a little bit off. They have a great advantage in that their service is almost entirely voluntary, and it's small. And they don't have, for instance, during the war, they really only got, as I recall, four divisions into action. Well, we had 79, I think. And we had a force about a third as large, or maybe half as large, in special troops, all of which we had to get and train. And we weren't allowed to take volunteers to any extent at all. Mr. Roosevelt allowed the Navy to proceed with the volunteers and the Marine Corps to proceed with volunteers for a long time. That made it very hard on the Army, very hard. And I think it's a most unwise procedure. I know it is in the end, there's no doubt about it at all. Of course they like it. Of course the Navy liked it. And of course the Air liked it. I saw the other day when they were commenting on this Lieutenant General, this superb leader that we developed, this Oklahoman, when he died, he wrote an article before he died for Life magazine, and went on to say why we should have universal training and everything of that sort. And at the end of the article in Life, they said, of course, the Air and the Navy, and he may have said Marines too, don't agree with this. Well, naturally they don't agree. They had every advantage in the world to have that, and it was not right. And you take in the naval thing, that is, to get a very efficient infantry outfit requires a world more training than it does for these other jobs. Because in the Navy, you know your job, you know where it is, you know the exact place you're going to stand for most of them during the battle. You take a bath before you go, you put on fresh underclothes, you sleep in the same bed that you slept in before you get into action, while the poor devil in the Army has marched tremendous distances. He's in the mud, he's filthy dirty, he hasn't had a full meal, and he makes his maximum exertion before the fight, and the minimum of sleep, and the minimum of well-prepared food, and then he fights in a place he's never seen before and probably goes into it during the hours of darkness. His communications are not fastened in by some contractor like the Westinghouse or that in a ship. his communications are mobile and have moved about and generally go into place during the night or very hastily in the daytime. He may never see them. He may work with artillery, never lays his eyes on, which labors far in rear and with the communications that carry up their carry back their reports of targets. So we almost never have had completely trained infantry. We came more near it in this war than in any other, but we were under great disadvantage in the fact these other services had volunteers, and we did not. It is under a completely mistaken illusion that was easy to train. It's been easy to badly train, and it's been badly trained in fact every war we had. And I made a Herculean effort to see that it was rightly trained in this war. And if I hadn't had a very friendly Congress with me, I never would have gotten by with it, because they thought that I was doing too much in the way of preparations of these men. I was moving them out to the West Coast to that desert training center. That cost money to get them out there. I gave them every bit of training of every kind that we could work out for them, and they profited greatly by it when they got over to Europe. General Bradley had quite a bit to do with the primary organization of the officer school.
Hold it for you a while, General.
No, I'll hold it. Let go of it. I did insist that the soldier be informed of what he was fighting for. At first they prepared pamphlets, very well prepared by experts from the colleges and all. But I found that as a rule they were presented after lunch and the man was tired and he went to sleep. The company officer that was explaining the thing was a very poor actor or performer, and I called in Frank Capra, the leading motion picture director at that time, and had him prepare the films, which were a complete education, I think, on the war, to civilians as well as to the recruits in the Army. And I had to do it, you might say, on the QT. I never allowed the Secretary of War to see it or the White House to see it until we had it finished. And Mr. Truman was thrilled by it, but Seeley had a good many ideas. And we got over to the White House, and Lowell Millette was mixed up with it, and I didn't get away for 4 months. I had to get out the troops in 2 weeks. I was raising an army, and I required that every soldier see that before he left the United States. And I think, remember the reports they gave me of the millions that saw it. Mr. Churchill got a hold of them and showed them all over England, and even prepared and delivered a introduction to the films. I think they're one of the best educational setups that I've ever seen, and they were very interesting, and they were done very expertly. They were amusing, they were serious, they were tremendous in their scope. I remember I took Mrs. Churchill over to see one that hadn't yet been released, and I would only do it on the basis that she would not mention it to anybody at the White House. And Field Marshal Dill took her up, and I went up to the little War Department projection room in the Pentagon, and she looked at this thing. She cried, she laughed, she was just thrilled to the last, and just begged me to let the Prime Minister see it. Well, I said, I can't exact a promise from the Prime Minister, and I don't want him to speak to the President because I'm not ready for the President to see it yet. And to put it frankly, I wanted to get on the road because I knew it would be called in, and we would fool around for a month or two to try to get the thing fixed up. And time was golden with me, and that had to be gotten out as fast as possible. Well, she promised me. And then she went over there and got to talking to Harry Hopkins, and they told the Prime Minister, and he got right on the phone and demanded, Hopkins got on the phone and said that the Prime Minister wanted to see it. And I said, he can't. And then the Prime Minister got on the phone, and Mr. Roosevelt was out of town at Hyde Park at the moment, and Mr. Churchill wanted to see this right away. Well, I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Churchill, because I don't want that to get out till it's ready. because I'll have all sorts of trouble with it if it does. And there were a series of these pictures, you see. And when you got it into the White House and a thing like that, you just never got it back. As I say, time was golden with me. And I was perfectly confident of what I had, that Capra in each case had done a superb job. They could use those things yet for great historical purposes. Anyway, Mr. Churchill came on and said he wanted it right away. Well, I said, Mr. Churchill, I'm sorry, but I can't give it to you. Well, he said, I'm asking you. Well, I said, I know you are, Mr. Churchill. And I know you're the Prime Minister of the British Commonwealth. And you're a guest of the President. But he hasn't seen it, and you're not going to see it ahead of him. Well, he said, when are you going to show it to him? I said, when it's finished. It isn't finished. I'll never get it finished if I get involved in this circuit that you are proposing. Well, he said, I want very much to see it, Marshal. Well, I said, if you will swear to me that you will not mention it to the President or anybody else. Mrs. Churchill promised me that, and then she went and mentioned it to you or Harry Hopkins. But if you will promise me that you won't mention it to anybody else, I'll send it over there for a private showing for you. Well, he said, I think you can hardly exact a promise from the Prime Minister of the British Empire that you just referred to. Well, I said, I can't, but I'll just not send the picture. That's the way to do it. I won't send it over. Well, he came back and he said, well, you got me there. I'll have to wait till the President gets back. Well, I said, if you tell him, you break a promise there. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to have this thing stalled by that sort of a procedure. I said, even the Secretary of War hasn't seen it, because I knew if I got all these people into it, I'd never get it done. And Capper's a great expert, and he had all the data, and he made up the thing, and I'm for it the way he's got it. Of course, there were a whole series of these pictures, the prelude to war, and then the things on the various countries, and they were beautifully done to educate our men who were going into these countries. Well, anyway, I sent it over, and Churchill had it. And then Churchill immediately sent back, and he wanted to take it to England. Well, I said, you can't do that till the President sees it. Well, I said, I'm going to hurry it up. Well, I said, it's the last damn thing you'll ever get from me if you do try to hurry it up. I'm doing a job, and you're interfering. I remember I repeated it twice. Well, he said, you certainly are stubborn. Well, I said, I'm not half as stubborn as you are, but I'm not going to get this out. I'm very, very fond of Mrs. Churchill. I admire her greatly, but I'll never forgive her for telling you, because I might have known that this would happen. Well, that's the way we got into this thing. And I didn't send it over to Mr. Rosenberg for quite a long time. And they kept it 4 months. But meanwhile, 3 million troops had seen it. I wouldn't let it go until 3 million men had seen it. And I don't know how much Lowell Millett had to think, but I know he was in the figure that our moving picture theaters didn't show it because it was over 50 minutes long, and every movie picture in England showed it. And the whole English got this education, and they were crazy about it. And I've always felt it was very tragic that our people didn't get the chance to see the picture, or pictures, rather. General McNair, 121. The weak points in training are the great difficulty of making it practical and the great difficulty of taking any officer, we'll say of company grade and major, and having to accept him as your professor, because it takes a great deal of imagination and a great deal of showmanship to make the maneuvers really as valuable as they should be. General McNair, 122, he was a senior officer. He was in charge of all the ground troop development in this country. And I felt that he was about as able a trainer as we could get, and very, very thorough. General Clark was his principal assistant, and he was one of the best training actors that I know about. And a lot of the organization of the new units, which played such a dominant part in the war, were of his devising. We'd sit down together at my desk and work out exactly how these new units would be formed, where everybody in it was selected. 124. The airborne unit was a collective enterprise. I was very strong for it. I opposed the way the air was used, even to the last. The pressure, of course, is to give each person air. They used it very much like the Federal Army, until Grant came along with Sheridan, used their cavalry in the Civil War. They pieced it all over the place. I've always felt, for instance, in the final battle in Normandy, that the plan that they'd worked out in detail for the air, but which Eisenhower's people didn't think they could safely risk, was the quick way to end the battle. And that was to seize a field near Paris with glider planes, with parachute troops, and then fly in these small tractors and other things, and then gather in all the motor transport of the surrounding country. And, of course, all the French undercover units would have joined us, and build up there with the ammunition which we could do. We could put in 105 guns and build up a force there right behind the German line before they had time to get things together, and make it almost impossible for them to do anything but fight you with small groups. However, that was a hazard. It was a brand new thing, and Eisenhower's staff, and Eisenhower, I guess, himself, didn't feel that it was proper to take the risk. But I always thought it was wrong to divide up these men into little groups everywhere. It is very natural for the commander to want them. It is very natural for them to want certain passes, certain crossings in connection with the first landing, going up to on the right flank on Utah Beach, and with General Montgomery over on his, Marshal Montgomery on his part of the front. But I believe the air could have been used with great effect in splitting up the Germans very quickly at the start. And the minute it was a little split up, the whole thing would more or less fall, because the continued reinforcement would be a very simple matter. And I think you'd have had all the undercover troops of the French accumulating there, and we could have let the ammunition and everything go into them very, very easily. General Maxwell Taylor came back to see me, and about the very thing you referred to here, and incidentally, he was a superb commander of this unit. I don't mind. Let's go. And he was sitting at my desk in the first conference we had on this matter when he got news of the attack on the Bulge. And he left, and as I recall, he left his hat, but I'm not quite certain, his cap. Anyway, he left my office, went straight to the plane, got in, and flew to get over to France, and got over very, very promptly. But he got the news while he was sitting at my desk.
Just